From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan State University reaches a $500 million settlement with Larry Nassar survivors.
Money will never solve the problem. It'll never heal our wounds, and it will never be enough to take back what happened. But it's the acknowledgement that comes along with this settlement that is priceless.
Look at this and look at it seriously. Don't let it happen on your watch.
The U.S. Senate votes on a measure that would protect net neutrality rules from being repealed.
I'm hoping, because so many people have weighed in sharing their concerns about, you know, this repeal of net neutrality, I'm hopeful that they will weigh in the House as well.
CBS TV actor Tony Trucks on her hometown of Manistee.
Manistee, I think, really sweats this sort of historic magic.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Michigan State University has reached a global settlement of $500 million with the 332 survivors of former sports doctor Larry Nassar. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we talk about what's in the final agreement with one of the attorneys involved in those negotiations, and we'll get a survivor's reaction. But first, the U.S. Senate is taking up net neutrality today. A bill that would protect net neutrality rules from repeal by the FCC passed a procedural hurdle earlier this afternoon. These Obama-era rules prevented internet service providers, Verizon and Comcast, for example, from speeding up or slowing down traffic from certain websites and apps. Barring changes made by Congress and signed by the president, the FCC's repeal of the rules goes into effect June 11th. I spoke with Michigan's senior senator, Debbie Stabenow, about this earlier today. Senator, this afternoon you and your colleagues will take a final vote on this measure. You only need 50 votes, which you say you already have, and then it goes to the House where passage is far less certain, no?
Now, that's the big question. I'm hoping, because so many people have weighed in sharing their concerns about, you know, this repeal of net neutrality, I'm hopeful that they will weigh in the House as well, because the House will have to vote on this, although the speaker could choose just not to take it up. So we need to push to have a vote and push to have a vote to overturn what will be in a very expensive and I think very unfortunate turn of events in our economy if, in fact, service providers are allowed to charge more for different levels of internet service.
Senator, do you see your way to any bipartisan fix? I know Senator John Thune has said he wants a bipartisan bill that he said would permanently ban blocking and throttling and this type of thing. Is that something you and other Democrats could work with?
Certainly. I mean, Senator Thune and I work on a lot of different issues. If he wants to put forward something that would fix this, that would be terrific. Now, they haven't done it yet. I think the first step to permanently fixing it, frankly, is to vote to stop this rule that repeals net neutrality from taking effect. Let's stop that. And then we can go ahead and put in place some permanent rules. But the internet, you know, is not some new sort of frill anymore. This is an integral part of our economy, the way we communicate, the way business is done. And we need to make sure that everybody has equal access to it.
I'd like to turn to China, specifically that tweet from President Trump this past Sunday, and I will quote it here. President Xi of China and I are working together to give massive Chinese phone company ZTE a way to get back into business fast. Too many jobs in China lost. What'd you think when that news came out?
Well, I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. Here we are trying to deal with the fact, first of all, that China is cheating all the time, stealing our intellectual property and doing things that are not in the interest of American jobs. We've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs simply because of the fact that they cheat when they value their currency. And so when we're looking at the fact that just a few weeks ago, the Commerce Department took action, which was the right thing, because this company violated U.S. sanctions against Iran and North Korea. They lied to the United States Commerce Department, and they were selling in violation of U.S. sanctions. So this is a national security issue for us with Iran as well as North Korea. And so our Commerce Department took action, as they should, strong enforcement action. And then the President of the United States suddenly reverses that because he's worried about Chinese jobs. I mean, it was stunning. And the other thing that is deeply, deeply concerning is, and I'm sure you've read, is that this news came just a few days after there was a business deal with a developer for a theme park in Indonesia that involved the Trump family business and involved Chinese government giving loans in $500 million from Chinese banks to this business enterprise that the Trump family is a part of.
Does that violate the emoluments clause, in your view?
Personally, I don't see how it doesn't. I mean, we've never had this before, first of all, where we've never gotten tax returns or we don't know the business relationships and how far they go with the current president. But then on top of that, even something that looked like it might violate, whether it technically did or not, it's just not something we've ever seen a president, Democrat or Republican, do. I mean, it's just the appearance of a situation where you're personally benefiting by American foreign policy or by changing things is, in my opinion, it's wrong. It's just simply wrong.
In pivoting over to the Trump administration's proposed tariffs on foreign steel and aluminum, I spoke yesterday with the CEO of an auto supplier, says she is angry and scared at what these tariffs may do to her Michigan-based company. What do you say to these people? What can you and Congress do for them?
Well, I spoke with Mary as well from Lucerne International, and we have to be very careful and strategic on how we take enforcement actions. And I've certainly been one that wants us to be tough against China, but we have to be very strategic and understand the implications of what's being done. And so, you know, at this point, the way this is being done in terms of the potential tariffs is of great concern to me. And a lot of our suppliers in Michigan are impacted, the folks making component parts and so on. And so they need to take another look at how they do this and the impact on American jobs. And so, you know, rather than the president tweeting that he's, you know, worried about Chinese jobs being lost, I wish he would focus on American jobs. That's what he said he was going to do when he was elected. And if he focuses on that, count me in. But I can't believe that he's suddenly concerned now about Chinese jobs, but not taking action and listening to people like Mary who are so deeply concerned about their business.
And also, let's talk public health. We've learned now that aides to EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt tried to block publication of a federal health study on chemical contaminants, including PFAS. And there are a number of communities in Michigan, particularly West Michigan, the Thumb, and their groundwater has been contaminated by these PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. And we hear that the publication was blocked after an aide to President Trump said it would cause a public relations nightmare. That study would have declared that these chemicals are a danger to human health at a far lower level than the EPA has said it was safe. So what is going on with this report?
Well, this goes back to the whole question of the role of government in terms of accurate information, protecting people's health. Overall, we can't protect our water or our air by ourselves. This is something we do together. That's why we have various rules and so on that we can count on to be able to have confidence we can drink the water and breathe the air and so on. And this area of PFAS is one that I've been involved in now for a number of months since this was brought to my attention, not only in West Michigan, where there have been private sector issues from tanning facilities and concerns about well contamination. But this particular kind of chemical has been used for years on our military facilities. And so what I've been focused on is getting some dollars for cleanup into the Department of Defense budget, which we've been able to do. It's just a start. It's certainly not enough to be able to address all the community needs, but being able to get this study, the health effect of these chemicals called PFAS, needs to be released. The study needs to be released. We need to understand the health effect so that families can take actions, communities can take actions, and the federal government has to take responsibility for the military sites and so on in terms of cleanup.
Can we rely on the EPA to help and protect us?
I'm very concerned about the current EPA and the current EPA administrator. That's why I didn't vote for him in the very beginning to be in that spot. This is somebody who seems very intent at rolling back safety rules at every turn. So it's deeply concerning to me. And we certainly saw with the president's budget last year, trying to eliminate all the money to protect the Great Lakes, I was able to put together a bipartisan coalition to be able to save every penny of that, which was great. We had a great coalition. But now they're back again trying to cut 90% of the money we need to protect our water. So it's just one thing after another, and it's very concerning to me.
Senator, we know your Republican colleagues met with President Trump yesterday, closed-door meeting, and now we're hearing not one of them pressed him about any of these matters, trade tariffs, ZTE, his aides comment about Senator McCain. Do you ever ask your Republican colleagues why they don't push back when they are face-to-face with the president?
You know, it's very concerning to me, and frankly, it's not explainable. I mean, I work with Republican colleagues across the aisle every day and have very good friendships, and it's disappointing, very disappointing to me to see what's happening. And I think all of us need to be working together to get things done, and that we've got to look beyond our own partisanship, and we have to look at what's best for the country.
Michigan Senior Senator Debbie Stabenow, as always, Senator, pleasure to talk with you, and thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Still to come, 172 years ago this week, Michigan became the first English-speaking government in the world to pass a law that abolishes the death penalty.
We've never had it. People aren't familiar with it. And there's just no particular desire to see it restored.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Your career may take you out of Michigan, but Michigan still has a piece of your heart. That's certainly the case with the Michigan-born and raised actors who wind up working in New York or Hollywood, but make plenty sure the world knows they're from Michigan. Jeff Daniels, Tim Allen, Kristen Bell, and my guest, Toni Trucks. She's been in a host of movies and TV shows, including her current role as Lisa Davis in SEAL Team on CBS. And it all started for her in her hometown of Manistee. And now she's lending her voice to help her hometown. Toni Trucks, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, what a warm welcome.
We're happy to have you here. And I read, tell me if I read correctly, your first time on stage was at the Ramsdell Regional Center for the Arts in Manistee.
That's correct.
How old were you and what was the role?
I was 7 or 8, and I was just in the chorus of Sweet Charity. And so I was just in the ensemble waving in the background and couldn't have been happier.
And the bug bit.
And the bug bit. I actually had seen a production of Most Happy Fella with my father, and there was a little girl that came by, I think, wheeling on a cake or something. And I was like, I did not get the memo that they were looking for little girls. How is this not me? And luckily, I had a really supportive father who ran downstairs and said, when's the next audition for the plays? And it was the next day. And so he took me, and the rest is history.
And I know that you're in LA now. When and why did you decide to do that?
Well, you know, I've been so supported by Michigan institutions. So, you know, Manistee really fostered and encouraged me and then kicked me out of the nest to Interlochen. Mm-hmm. And so I graduated from Interlochen. Interlochen then kicked me out of the nest to the University of Michigan. So I went to University of Michigan's musical theater program, and they lovingly made a beautiful gateway for me to go to New York and get an agent right away. So I went to New York first because I wanted to do Broadway. And my agent there, after 2 years, sent me out for a random TV show, and I booked it and moved to Los Angeles and started a totally different career that I had not expected.
It's interesting, and I think you do see a lot of people out of Michigan find that home in the theater, and Kristen Bell was in the theater, you did theater, Jeff yep. Daniels started, got caught up in movies and couldn't wait. I remember him telling me, once the kids got old enough, I'm going back to New York, and indeed he did.
Yep.
And you've worked steadily. I mean, your IMDb page, I checked it out, you have 39 credits, including Twilight Saga, Breaking yes. Dawn Part 2. That cracking Hollywood, you went out, you said, you almost sound surprised. I booked it.
Yeah.
This show.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it was not what I expected. I thought I just wanted to do Broadway. I was like Broadway yeah. bound, and kept doing regional theater around, in and around New York. So to all of a sudden be like, in 2 weeks you must be at Paramount Studios in Los Angeles. You're living in a hotel, and here's your golf cart. You know what I mean? You're sort of like, what is happening?
Wow.
So it's very exciting. But, you know, I don't know why Michigan fosters such vibrant performers. We just pump them out, you know. And James Earl Jones is also from Ramsdale Theater. And we actually got some exciting news while I was home last week that James Earl Jones has lent his voice to the theater. So we are the only American theater to have James Earl Jones welcoming Manistee audiences to every production.
Oh, good heavens.
And telling him to turn off your cell phone.
And if James Earl Jones tells you, you will do that.
He will do it.
And here you've gotten involved in this big effort promoting Manistee's historic trademark or landmarks, and you've done a load of narration for a series of videos. How are these videos used, Tony?
Manistee County Visitors Bureau has made this beautiful, comprehensive historic tour. There's actually 100 different sites on the tour. We have to date recorded about 30 different voiced tours that you can see online. So if you're walking around Manistee and perhaps you come to building that is privately owned mm-hmm. or you can't get into for whatever reason, there's a QR code that you can scan with your phone and it'll take you to a virtual tour that I've voiced. And so there's about 30 of those. Those are separated up into 8 themed tours. And there's also an app you can get on your phone. If you go to any of your app stores, mm-hmm. go to Manistee County, it'll pop right up and you can take a virtual tour from anywhere in the world if you want.
Why do you love Manistee so much?
You know, my dad and I were trying to dissect this the other day. He's like, you just love old buildings. And I always have. You would think growing up around them that I would maybe perhaps not really see them as much. But for some reason, I've always been so enamored with them. And Manistee, I think, really sweats this sort of historic magic it has about it. So when you walk into, for example, the historic Ramsdale Theater, it has so much history and these ghosts are really present. And all of the buildings, the downtown area, everything is just so old and beautiful. The homes are Victorian. There's painted ladies everywhere. Even the, you know, like the Briney building, the Ironworks building, there's big, rich history. I feel like when I'm in Los Angeles or out in the world, I'm always trying to articulate how special I think Manistee is. Mm-hmm. So this project is really giving me a way to articulate that. There's just so many stories. And also, you know, the area is rich with the Native American history that the tribe is so integral to our area. So it's this weird juxtaposition of, you know, Native American culture, but also the Victorian era when Manistee had its boom. So I just love it. And I hope that people come to see it.
Well, it's certainly clear you're not just reading words. This is really something that, I mean, you grew up there and it still brings you back. You have your dad here with us today, so we know you have family here. You have a lot of roots in Michigan.
Absolutely. So many roots. And it's a tiny way in which I can give back. Manistee really encouraged me and supported me and told me yes all the time as a little person. And I think that having that energy as my foundation as an artist was so special.
I know the season finale of SEAL Team is tonight, and you're back next season?
Yep, we've got picked up for another 22 episodes. So we'll start our season 2 filming in July, probably premiere the second season in September.
Well, enjoy your Michigan vacation,
Tony.
Thank
you.
Tony Trucks, thank you so much for being with us, the voice of the new Manistee Historic Sites Tours. It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
This Friday marks the 172nd anniversary of a uniquely Michigan milestone. On May 18th, 1846, Michigan became the first English-speaking government in the world to pass a measure to abolish the death penalty. Here with us now to discuss Michigan's progressive past is the state archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you.
Also joining us now is the senior United States District Judge for the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan. He graduated from the University of Michigan Law School in 1949. He was admitted to the Michigan State Bar later that year. President Jimmy Carter appointed him to the federal bench in September of 1979. It is a pleasure to welcome Judge Avern Cohn to Stateside. Judge Cohn, it's so good to have you with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Good to have you, especially your historic and legal context. Mark, I'm going to start with some background with you. First, Michigan banned the death penalty in 1846, about 10 years after becoming the 26th state in the Union. Was capital punishment common prior to that ban?
No, it wasn't, considering the time period. The first recorded case of capital punishment by Europeans in the region was a French execution in 1683. And typically, even when someone was convicted and sentenced to execution, they would be transported to Montreal for the actual execution. There were only 7 known cases of capital punishment in the territory that we know as Michigan now prior to 1805, when Michigan became an official territory, and only 6 more after territorial status between 1805 and 1846, when Michigan became the first state to ban it. I think it's interesting to note that of those 13 executions, 7 were Native Americans, 5 Caucasians, and 2 women, including 1 unnamed slave.
And I know around the time of statehood, there were a couple of executions that happened that, kind of looking back, they're cited as a turning point on changing Michiganders' view of the death penalty. What were those cases?
Yeah, I don't know if that is hindsight or not, but we can continue to debate that. But there were a couple notable cases. The first included Patrick Fitzpatrick, a Detroiter living in Windsor. In 1828, he was accused of raping and killing an innkeeper's daughter in Windsor. He was tried, convicted, and executed. 7 years later, in 1835, Fitzpatrick's former roommate confessed on his deathbed to the murder. So, innocent man executed. And then in 1836, the year before Michigan was admitted to the Union, Detroiter Stephen Simmons reportedly came home drunk, had a dispute with his wife because she wouldn't continue to drink with him, and punched her so hard in the abdomen that she died. The scene was witnessed by their 2 daughters. Once sober, Simmons was beside himself with grief and repentance. He was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. This was the last known public execution in Michigan, not only the last state-sponsored execution, but the last public execution, and it was a spectacle. They set up gallows and seating. It was quite the event. Wayne County Sheriff Thomas Knapp refused to carry out the act, so our territorial governor, Lewis Cass, had to find somebody to carry forward the execution, and he tapped Benjamin Woodward as the temporary sheriff to do that. When asked for his last words, Simmons began singing a repentant spiritual hymn, and it's thought that this, you know, changed the festive mood of the occasion to something pretty somber, although that's just conjecture again. But it left this lasting imprint on that idea of public execution.
So how did the political movement then get rolling to ban the death penalty in Michigan? Was there like a coalition of unlikely partners, or did everybody kind of unite under the sense that the morally correct thing to do was to not put people to death? Judge Cohn.
Well, in 1846, the legislature asked a lawyer from Oakland County to collect and revise the criminal code for the state, which was scattered through the books. He submitted a comprehensive revision of the criminal code and included a provision in that the penalty for murder was life imprisonment. That, by implication, abolished the death penalty for murder. He did not exclude treason. So in 1846, when the legislature adopted the revised criminal code, it included a provision that the penalty for treason, state treason, was death, and all the other penalties similar stopped at life in prison. it went through the legislature without any great difficulty. I think the reason why it was at ease was the execution in Windsor shook everybody up because they discovered that they had executed an innocent man. So from 1846 forward, the penalty for first-degree murder was life in prison. There were several attempts after that to restore the death penalty for murder, and none of them got very far. In 1931, the legislature passed a statute that restored the death penalty for murder, but provided that there would be a public referendum. And in 1931, in a general election, that provision was rejected by the voters.
So the public was saying, no, we don't want this.
We don't want this. In 1963, when Magwin proposed that it be inserted in the state constitution, it also affected the penalty for treason, which had been on the books but never been used. And so when the new constitution was adopted, it forbade the death penalty for any crime.
And Mark, the reaffirmation of abolishing the death penalty in Michigan's 1963 constitution, that had broad support from both political parties?
It had overwhelming bipartisan support, passing 108-3. This was a convention opened by former President Dwight D. Eisenhower. He gave the opening speech, and nearly two-thirds of the delegates were Republicans. So by today's standards, where we typically think of red states as being pro-capital punishment, this was unique.
And as we know, Judge Cohn, the federal government could and can continue to execute people within our state. Judge Cohn, would you tell us about a federal case in the 1930s that involved a man named Anthony Chebatoris?
Yes. Anthony Chebatoris attempted to rob a bank in Midland, Michigan, and in a shootout with the police, Chebatoris killed, I believe, a police officer. I'm not sure. He was then charged with first-degree murder under federal law, because robbing a bank was a federal crime. From the time the crime occurred until the time Chebatoris was convicted was about 31 days. And under the concept of dual sovereignty, that the United States is a separate sovereign from the state, you could have the death penalty under federal law. It took about a year, though, after he was convicted and sentenced for the conviction to be affirmed. And he was then taken to Milan, where the execution took place. There was an effort to stop it on the grounds that the federal government should not conduct an execution in a state where under the state public policy it was forbidden. But the federal government persisted, and Chebatoris was then hung at Milan, Michigan. That's the only death that has occurred under federal law in Michigan. There is a case in the Western District of Michigan, a man by the name of Marvin Gabrion, who in 2002 was convicted of murder of a woman in a national forest, which made it a federal crime. The jury in that case had to decide first whether or not Gabrion was guilty of first-degree murder. In a separate hearing, the jury then said he should be executed for it. The case went to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals affirmed his conviction, and to my knowledge, he has yet to be executed, although it was ordered 20 years ago, and I'm not sure of the current status of the Gabrion case, but the judge who tried the case, now retired, was quoted as saying he doubted that the execution would ever be carried out. Hmm. If the execution is carried out, he will be sent to a federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, where they have facilities for implementing the death penalty. But after 20 years after trial, it seems to me that it's doubtful that he will ever be executed.
Judge Cohn, you've been a Michigander for over 90 years. You have, you know, watched history through the decades. Why do you think some of your fellow citizens have tried at times to revive capital punishment in Michigan?
Well, every time you get an incident where a police officer or a young child or somebody is murdered, the public are aroused and don't think that that person should be allowed to live. However, there's been very little substantive movement to restore the death penalty. I believe in 2015, Attorney General Schuette suggested that it might be reconsidered in the case of a murder of a police officer, but his efforts got nowhere. The fact is, so far as I can tell, the public attitude is we've never had it, people aren't familiar with it, and there's just no particular desire to see it restored. I, about 10, 15 years ago, had a death penalty case on my docket, and I impaneled a jury for the case and then asked prospective jurors questions about their attitude towards the death penalty. Most of them gave me a blank look initially because they had just never thought about it. The people in Michigan just aren't interested in it.
It sounds like a lot of tradition over the years, as you say. It just is something that seems alien to most people's minds.
It's alien to all of us.
Well, we have terrific legal and judicial perspective from you. We want to thank you so much, Federal Judge Averyn Cohn. And also, thank you to the State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, giving us context as Michigan marks the 172nd anniversary of being the first English-speaking government in the world to vote and pass a law abolishing the death penalty. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Coming up, Michigan grows a lot of apples, and one way to use apples, hard cider.
We try to maintain the malic acid that is resident in the apple, so it's kind of an acidic bite.
Plus, Nassar survivors take a major step towards settlement with Michigan State University. We'll be right back after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, if you only focus on the craft brews or the wines made in Michigan, you're missing a growing part of the Michigan beverage scene, cider. Cider Week GR is happening right now through the 19th in Grand Rapids. It includes the annual Great Lakes Cider and Perry Competition. It's the largest competition of its kind in the world, according to Paul Vanderhyde, who owns Vandermill LLC of Grand Rapids. They make more than 250,000 gallons of cider a year, and they sell it in a number of Great Lakes states. Paul's also the president of the United States Association of Cider Makers. Paul, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Cider kind of has come in and out of favor for the American drinker. Can you tell us a little bit about that history?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people don't know that if you go far back enough to colonial times in the United States, cider was the most consumed alcoholic beverage for a number of different reasons. One was access to fruit was pretty available, and for two, you had limited availability of reliable fresh water. So a lot of folks would ferment cider as a way of just something safe to drink. The alcoholic fermentation process is a natural cleansing of bacteria and things that bother our body. So if you go back that far, it was one of the most popular things. And then post-prohibition, it really kind of fell out of favor as beer took over things. And we saw a few times in the last 20 years or so that cider has popped its head up. In the 90s was a very popular time for cider, and there were a few national brands at that time. And then really it was first decade of the 2000s that craft cider started making an appearance again, and we've seen this resurgence since then. It's been great.
What do you think has caused this resurgence?
You know, a lot of it, I think, is people and their kind of general interest in knowing where products come from, especially products that they're consuming. The local food movement, local beverage movement has certainly played a big role of it. And then also the popularity of craft beer, you know, has given people the sense that they're willing to try new things, willing to step out of what they are used to, and I think that has benefited cider as well.
You talk a lot, Paul Vanderhyde, about educating drinkers to bring cider to their palates. How do you go about doing this?
Well, the best way is literally getting it on their palate. A lot of folks don't really know what cider is. Folks will use the term cider beer, which there's no brewing process in cider making, so we're trying to educate them that that's not a thing. We also have a bit of a misunderstanding as to what cider is relative to sweet cider that people tend to know about.
Why don't you get everybody on board with that right now?
Yeah, well, cider, you know, if you go to areas in Europe where, and you use the word cider, it's by default, people imagine a fermented apple juice. Here in the U.S., we've come to know cider to be, you know, the brown sweet juice that you get fresh from your local cider mill or orchard, when really we would call that apple juice. And we would think of cider as being a fermented beverage. So it's literally just a definition misunderstanding, and you know that's why we end up referring to hard cider as kind of giving that influence of alcohol. So we're in the industry, we're happy to let people say whatever they like as long as they're drinking the beverage, but we try to steer them towards what we're really making is cider, and cider is a fermented beverage of apple juice.
What does, in your mind, a good Michigan cider taste like?
Michigan grows great apples. The dominating market for our apple supply is definitely the fresh market. People go into the grocery store and picking out apples for fresh eating or culinary use. Because that's what's predominantly available to us, we end up using that fruit for cider making as well. A good friend of mine who's also in the Michigan wine industry long ago told me, you know, what we should be doing is we should be representing the fruit to the best of our ability post-fermentation, similar to what a grape winemaker would want to do is represent the essence of the fruit. So in our case, Michigan apples tend to be sweet and bright and crisp and acidic. So for Vandermill, anyway, what we like to present first and foremost is that quality of the fruit. So our ciders tend to be, they range from sweet to dry, but we try to maintain the malic acid that is resident in the apple, so it's kind of an acidic bite to it, more so than what a lot of other beverages tend to present. And then just a nice clean fermentation, so you get some apple aroma and that wonderful fermented flavor of apple. I will say, though, that people shouldn't expect a hard cider to taste like apple juice any more than you would expect, you know, your red wine to taste like grape juice. So there is that distinction. But we do try to hold on to the qualities of the apple the best we can.
Why is it that West Michigan is such a hot spot in cider production?
You know, the number one answer is apples. Michigan is the third largest producer of apples in the country, and it's not a surprise, I suppose, that the majority of these craft cider producers around the country, and Michigan's no different, is coming from apple-growing regions. And Michigan is doing a fantastic job on even a national standard of having very good quality cider and a lot of producers. We have, I think, upwards of about 80 wineries and cideries that are producing cider in the state. And we're very well represented on the national craft scene, so it's great.
What about the relationship between a cider maker and an apple farmers? Do you work with specific growers? I'm wondering how that works.
We do. In one particular case, we work with the Dietrich family here in West Michigan, and we've actually worked on a project with them to grow specific apples for us, more traditional, some English and French varieties of apples, which are long sought after by American cider producers. And then we work with a number of different orchards to procure, you know, the culinary and or fresh varieties that we use year-round.
Now, I'm curious how you compete with other craft beverage makers, especially the craft beer folks, which have taken Grand Rapids by storm. How do you mount that challenge?
You know, I think even amongst the craft brewers, there's certainly competition, but there's a camaraderie and a common goal of getting people to drink products that are made locally and made with the unique care that each producer brings to it. And we have kind of the same relationship with brewers and craft distillers and other winemakers. Cider is such a small part yet of the total beverage category. I believe nationally it's less than 2% of beer alone, less than 1% of all craft beverage. So we're really looking at, you know, the scale of a lot of the national producers who still retain a considerable amount of market share. I think craft producers in many cases band together in the effort of trying to bring people a local beverage But at the same time, we're competing for shelf space, we're competing at bars and restaurants for tap handles and exposure. But thus far, it's been a very friendly environment to be in and really rather refreshing.
Paul Vanderhut is president of the United States Association of Cider Makers, and he owns Vandermill LLC of Grand Rapids. Paul, thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, and keep drinking that cider. We hope we get more of your listeners doing it as well.
Michigan State University today agreed to pay a $500 million settlement to hundreds of sexual assault survivors of Larry Nassar. The deal was announced by MSU and the lawyers for 332 survivors earlier today. Stephen Drew is with the Grand Rapids law firm of Drew, Cooper, and Anding. His team represents more than 120 Nassar survivors. The negotiations happened in California, and we caught Stephen as he was boarding a plane home at LAX. Stephen, what are your first thoughts about this settlement with MSU?
I think it sends a great message to other institutions. We're very pleased with the amount, obviously, $500 million, but we hope that that makes a lot of institutional change. We hope that it never happens again because it sends the right message how serious this is for something that's gone on for over 20 years. So we're pleased with that. There's still a lot to be done, a lot to recognize, a lot to believe people when they say something is wrong and to address it right away. So this is a start. This is a great start in that sense.
So Michigan State, the release from the university said this is a global settlement in principle. What does that mean legally?
That means legally that this is an agreement, that amount of money, the $500 million total, the $425 million for the current survivors, the 332, will be placed in a fund. We will have control over that, and then there will be a process set up for distribution. It also means that there's $75 million that will be put into a fund for future claims, and that 8% of that, I believe, goes to Michigan State for handling those claims. So if other claims come up within a certain amount of time, then that money will be available. If that does not resolve it and there's some money left, it comes back to the fund for our clients.
Stephen, are all your clients in agreement with this settlement?
We're going to assume that they all are. We obviously have to discuss the terms and everything with them. But all, you know, the responses have been tears, joy, thank you. It finally recognizes what we've been through. It recognizes the seriousness of what this was. So we'll be moving forward with that part of it as well.
Stephen, there was some talk over the months of non-monetary items in the settlement, board resigning or education and support programs. Are there any non-monetary items in the settlement?
That's a good question. As a part of this settlement, there are no agreed-to non-monetary terms.
Okay.
That's all I can say because we can't get into the actual, you know, terms of the negotiation and the mediation. But as a part of this settlement, there are not any agreed-upon non-monetary terms. It's strictly a monetary settlement at this point.
Okay. And I know this settlement does not address any claims against USA Gymnastics or the U.S. Olympic Committee or TwiStars and its owner, John Gettert, only Michigan State University. What was your primary goal in all of your negotiations with MSU?
Our goal always was to have them recognize the seriousness of what had occurred and to hopefully, and I know it sounds trite, but make sure that this never happens again, to recognize why it happened and to make sure, I mean, child abuse and abuse of children, abuse of athletes in a section, is terrible. It should not happen. It cannot continue to happen. And so that has been our goal. That has been the goal of the clients from the beginning. And as you know, most wanted to remain anonymous at first because of the fear, the backlash. No one was believing them. A few courageous ones came out. And then Kyle Stevens, who's one of our clients, came out and told of all of that. And that, and it just snowballed. These ladies came forth very courageous. And believe me, them coming forth the way they did, instead of remaining anonymous, most of them, makes a big difference. It allowed them to tell the story. The world heard about it. And that's made a difference in how we can move forward. So we hope, really, that there is change that occurs, not just at Michigan State, but at a number of other institutions. Look at this and look at it seriously. Don't let it happen on your watch.
Attorney Stephen Drew, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Morgan McCall is here with us now. She was 12 years old when she walked into the MSU Sports Medicine Clinic and encountered Larry Nassar for the first time. She's now a student at the University of Michigan. Morgan, how are you feeling about this news?
I'm relieved. We've been fighting for this for 19 months, and we're finally getting some sort of accountability out of MSU. That being said, we still have a lot of institutions that have yet to speak up and stand up for what's right, and we still have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, what was your main goal in pursuing the legal action against Michigan State?
Main goal was the non-monetary demands. We want to see real institutional changes, policy changes, structure reform, things put in place on that campus to make sure that little girls don't have to go through this again. And we still have yet to see that. And so, you know, while this is great, we still have so much work to do.
Non-monetary demands are not a part of this particular settlement. So you're saying you didn't get everything you wanted out of this?
Unfortunately not. And we have to keep fighting for that ourselves. I mean, I think the Spartan community is happy to rally around us because it truly benefits us all when we make those changes.
You know, this is such a crucial moment in a very, very important story. And here you are in the middle of this all, something that you never asked for when you were 12 years old, walking in there to get treated for dance injuries. So what comes next for you? What's most important to you?
Continuing the advocacy. The momentum that we started in the past 19 months, rallies, protests, calls to legislative leaders, this doesn't stop now, and it certainly won't stop in the future. I think we have really started something here that we intend to continue and see through to fulfillment.
Certainly, it was obvious at the graduation ceremony for Michigan State University when many of the graduating seniors refused to shake Interim President Engler's hand. They dropped teal flowers at his feet and walked off the stage. Is that something you're feeling is support from the general community as well as this community of survivors that you're a part of?
Certainly. I think we all have support, whether you know, you're a Spartan fan, you're a student at the university, you're a faculty member, you're a survivor of Nassar or of someone else. We want to see that campus made better, and we want to make these changes. And, you know, that disconnect is happening on the highest level in the upper administration. I hope that this marks a change so that not only survivors' voices are heard and empowered, but the Spartan community at large.
Morgan McCall, what does this settlement, this $500 million settlement, say to other schools, to other institutions? What do you think?
It is acknowledgement of the true damage and trauma that happens to survivors when they undergo something so traumatic as sexual abuse or assault. I think money will never solve the problem. It'll never heal our wounds, and it will never be enough to take back what happened. But it's the acknowledgement that comes along with this settlement that is priceless.
And what does achieving this settlement, this global settlement with Michigan University, what does it say in your eyes to others who have survived any kind of sexual assault and perhaps never spoken of it?
It tells them that what happened to them is valid, it's real, and the effects of it are real. And I think it marks a true change in the way that Michigan treats survivors of sexual assault. And I hope that in the aftermath of this, we create a safer Michigan for them to come forward.
Morgan McCall, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scott. Stateside's executive producer is Jolynn Stroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.